It's been hugely helpful in getting the Arctic nations to work together.
The U.S. takes the lead on the Arctic Council starting tomorrow. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a teenager recovers from a meth addiction.
It makes you feel cut off from your emotions. And you just kind of get lost in this different world.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The United States takes over tomorrow as chair of the Arctic Council, the international body of representatives from eight nations with territory in the region. U.S. delegates say they'll focus on the impact of climate change on the Arctic and its peoples. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, observers say the Council's work won't be disrupted by divisions among some of its members.
Fran Ulmer can speak from experience about the importance of the Arctic Council and its work on finding solutions to problems in the region.
It's been hugely helpful in getting the Arctic nations to work together on things like the two agreements that were just adopted in the last few years, the Search and Rescue Agreement and the Responding to Oil Spills Agreement.
Ulmer served as Lieutenant Governor and later as Chancellor of the University of Alaska at Anchorage before being appointed in 2010 to the National Commission on the BP Horizon Oil Spill, and then in 2011 as Chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. She says it's important to understand the significance of the United States assuming the Arctic Council Chairman because of the organization's research on climate change and its impact on this region, and the growing importance of that work as Arctic nations ramp up development of oil and other resources here.
To the extent that people are thinking long-term about where's energy going to come from, the Arctic is one of the places where it is highly likely where's energy going to come from, that it will be a supply source, whether it's from Russian waters or Canadian waters or U.S. waters or Norwegian waters.
The opportunity to exploit those resources is due in part to melting sea ice.
Last week, we had the lowest winter sea ice extent ever recorded in the Arctic.
The sea ice melt has opened up previously inaccessible offshore areas to oil and gas exploration and development.
30% of the undiscovered gas in the world is in the Arctic region. 13% of the undiscovered oil is projected to be in the Arctic region.
Ulmer says Arctic Council member nations have worked together to develop plans and policies to deal with the tricky business of developing Arctic oil resources, while at the same time researching the impacts of burning those fossil fuels on the region's climate and its peoples. She says the Council cooperates because its members understand they're all in it together.
If there's a spill someplace in the Arctic because of Arctic Ocean currents, it's going to affect wildlife, it's going to affect fish, it's going to affect shorelines, not just in one country, but in other countries.
But some observers believe international tensions are now creating divisions among Arctic Council members. They note that Secretary of State John Kerry will lead the U.S. delegation at the Council's ministerial meeting that convenes Friday morning in Iqaluit, the capital of the Canadian territory of Nunavut. But his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, won't be there, reportedly as a tit-for-tat response to snubs by the Canadians, who didn't attend an Arctic Council meeting last year in Moscow, to protest Russian aggression in Ukraine and Crimea.
There's no way to de-link completely the Arctic from geopolitics in the world.
That's Lawson Brigham. He's a UAF Distinguished Professor of Geography and Arctic Policy and a retired strategic planner for the Coast Guard. Brigham says he doesn't think the U.S.-Canadian dispute will disrupt this weekend's meeting. He says the Arctic Council specifically prohibited itself from involvement in military matters when it was formed in 1996. And he thinks it's unlikely that Russian saber-rattling in the Arctic will lead to hostilities because that would be bad for business.
The notion that we're headed to some sort of regional conflict in the Arctic, I don't buy it, because all of the countries, including our Russian friends, want to sell natural resources to the planet.
But Matt Felling, an aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski, says Russia's military buildup in the region isn't going unnoticed.
We've seen them moving military aircraft. We've seen them boosting their military muscle in the Arctic.
Felling says Murkowski believes that shouldn't deter the Arctic Council from its work because it's the biggest Arctic nation with the biggest stake in developing the region's resources. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The U.S. Senate today voted to confirm Loretta Lynch as Attorney General. Both Alaska senators voted against her, saying she has not shown she has the independence to stand up to the Obama White House. As Senator Lisa Murkowski put it, the AG should serve as a firewall against executive overreach, not an apologist for the president's prerogatives. Lynch was confirmed by a vote of 56-43. Alaska mining advocates are taking issue with something Interior Secretary Sally Jewell said last week while defending federal resource management in Alaska. Here's what Jewell said.
We are in no way preventing development of Alaska's resources on public lands. We're facilitating development in a number of areas. Much of the mining in Alaska is on public lands.
The Alaska Miners Association has written a letter to Jewell disputing that much of Alaska's mining is on federal lands. Alaska has six big mines. Two, Kensington and Greens Creek in southeast, are on federal land. The others are on state and native land. Deantha Crockett, executive director of the mining group, says Alaska has more than 400 placer mines, but only about 80 are on federal land.
I think our concern is when you say much, you're talking about 18% of placer mines and two out of six large-scale mines, and I guess I don't consider that to be much.
Crockett says the lack of mining activity on federal land didn't happen by accident. More than 60% of the state is federal land, but Crockett says too much is closed to mining.
And then the acreage that is administered by the federal government that isn't closed to mineral entry, frankly, there are tremendous permitting delays and a whole bunch of bureaucracy that's affecting these operations from moving forward.
Crockett says the BLM is hampered by staff turnover and budget constraints. She says the Alaska Miners Association is offering to help the Interior Department simplify the permitting process to speed it along. An Interior Department official counting both pending and active mining plans and notices says there are 176 mining sites on federal land in Alaska. A jury has convicted a 59-year-old Tanana man on evidence tampering charges after two Alaska State Troopers were shot to death. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports Arvin Kangas began to cry after the verdict was read today. The jury was to resume deliberations on whether aggravating circumstances could increase the sentence. Prosecutors claimed Kangas moved handguns belonging to the two troopers after his son allegedly shot and killed them last year. The jury heard about 1 hour of combined audio and video footage taken before, during, and after the shooting. The footage comes from audio recorders worn by the officers and nearly 30 minutes of video taken by a neighbor. Arvin Kangas' son, Nathaniel Kangas, faces trial in November for the deaths of Sergeant Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Governor Bill Walker gets a new name from the Tlingit-Kagwantan clan.
It was all brand spanking new to me, and it's just such an honor. My adopted name now is Goochwalk.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast offers an online occupational endorsement in financial institutions, covering banking and accounting concepts and principles. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This week, we're exploring the blind spot. It's a focus on teens who are using substances but aren't being caught by the system that's set up to help them. In this story, KSKA's Ann Hillman spoke with a couple relying on each other to get through their past methamphetamine addiction.
The two young women sit in an empty classroom, their hands intertwined. A knit cap is pulled low over Madison's shaggy hair. A Batman belt holds up her baggy pants. Kylie wears a pastel hoodie over her thin body and tight jeans. Neither of those are their real names because one of them is a minor. They just started school again after they both dropped out more than a year ago, before they even knew each other. They met last year when Madison joined her friend for dinner at Kylie's dad's house.
They had meatloaf. It was really good. I mean, and I met her, but no, I'm just getting the meatloaf.
By the time they met, Madison had already started using meth.
I remember exactly where it was. It was like downtown Anchorage in the JCPenney stairwell, because believe it or not, a lot of people do drugs down, like, in all those places. So if you ever see people standing in the stairwell, they're probably doing drugs. But
then, after meeting Kylie, she stopped. Kylie grew up in a house where her father and older siblings frequently used drugs. Madison didn't want her to have to deal with a girlfriend who was using too. And then Madison relapsed, with Kylie's dad. And Kylie decided it was time for her to try it too.
For me, it was more that I was closer to my family if I did it, because I was always cut out from my family, mainly because I have younger siblings that were allowed around our family because they didn't know what everybody was doing. But I did, and I was old enough, and so I wasn't allowed around them. But then being on it, I was.
So Madison and Kylie went on a 6-month bender with friends and family members. They figured they used thousands of dollars worth of drugs and paid almost nothing for them. Madison says meth helped them escape.
It makes you feel cut off from your emotions. And you just kind of get lost in this different world.
They'd forget to eat. They'd forget to sleep. Kylie says it all started with just wanting to try it one time.
One time, and 6 months later, you're like 100 pounds and nobody, your own family doesn't want to be around you. And it's awful.
When they were on meth, they didn't even like each other.
We were awful together.
Yeah, we were awful to each other and together.
Kylie says Madison is whiny and needy when she's on methamphetamines. Madison says Kylie's really annoying.
She's just everywhere, and then she's not everywhere, and she's like always writing letters, always writing. And it's like, hey, and she's just like, hold on a minute. And she's just writing, and it's like, and then she never sends the letters anyway.
But when Kylie's off drugs, she's a completely different person. A person Madison says she loves.
She's really funny, she smiles a lot, and she laughs a lot, and she's really goal-orientated, too, when she's sober. Like, she wants to get things done. She does job applications, she looks out for herself.
Madison says on the days they didn't use meth, that's the person she would see. And she'd see a change in herself, too. She says she always knew using meth was a bad idea, and seeing the differences in the people around her made her realize she needed a change if she was ever going to reach the goals she set for herself. So Madison set an ultimatum for Kylie.
And she said that if we were ever adults, she would not want to have a family with kids with a mother that was as messed up as I had been.
I know that sounds really harsh, but...
But it's the truth. And she said that we didn't need to set goals for when we had kids. We needed to do it before so that we were ready to have kids.
Madison says she wanted to show Kylie a better life than she had experienced. But Madison is also the one who led Kylie to try meth. So why does Kylie still trust her?
Nobody's ever told me that they supported me or they believed in me, but she has.
In order to stop, the young couple moved to Wasilla to stay with friends. Madison says they had to get away from everyone who was still using.
Okay, if you try to quit and you're still around all those people that do drugs and all the druggies, then...
It makes it 1,000 times harder.
They slip into what's becoming a normal relationship, finishing each other's sentences, squabbling over housework, and supporting each other through what Madison says has to be a personal decision.
You have to make the decision to leave and get better for yourself.
Madison says she has relapsed and used meth since trying to get clean, but she says she knows it's part of the process and she just has to move on. They both say it's hard, but together they're trying. In Wasilla, I'm Ann Hillman.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has released a list of academic program cuts and changes in response to reduced state funding. As KYC's Dan Bross reports, the cost-saving measures are the first of numerous expected as UAF tries to cover a more than $20 million budget hole.
University of Alaska Fairbanks degree programs in the chemistry, music, sociology, philosophy, engineering, and science management departments will be discontinued after current majors complete them. UAF Chancellor Brian Rogers says the 6 degree programs were selected for elimination based on 3 criteria.
Those programs that had the lowest enrollment, the lowest graduation rates, or falling enrollment.
Rogers explains that while the specific majors are going away, the broader disciplines will remain.
There will continue to be instruction in the field. We will just not be offering a major in that field.
Other cost-saving measures rolled out by the university Wednesday include suspension, merging, consolidation, and/or redesign of 8 other degree and certificate programs, as well as development of plans to recruit students and find new funding for numerous others. 12 more programs are still being reviewed for action. The elimination of degree programs will result in the loss of faculty once current majors graduate. Philosophy Department Chair Eduardo Wilner suspects the university won't have qualified professors to teach philosophy courses essential to other degree programs.
Classes in STEM fields, you know, science, technology, you know, and mathematics, applied philosophy classes, ethics, research ethics.
Wilner stresses that those kind of classes are key to critical thinking in all fields.
We're knifing near the heart of the interior campus ability to create, you know, competent, innovative, creative new leaders.
Chancellor Rogers contends that although the university will be a smaller institution, it's not fundamentally changing.
Continue our focus as an Arctic-based university serving the state of Alaska, very heavily science and engineering-based, but with a real grounding in the liberal arts as well.
Rogers says the academic program cuts are expected to yield $1 to $1.5 million in annual savings. UAF is anticipating a $25 million budget gap, and Rogers points to additional cuts affecting a range of non-academic university programs that will be rolled out through the end of June when the budget is finalized. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
A privately owned Cessna 185 airplane made an emergency landing at Nome City Field Airport this afternoon. The Nome Police Department received a distress call regarding a small aircraft that possibly would not make the city landing strip just before 1 o'clock today. Nome Fire Chief Jim West Jr. says the single-engine Cessna 185 departed Nome earlier in the afternoon and was on its way to White Mountain when the pilot noticed that the plane's landing gear was out of alignment on one side. The pilot returned to Nome and performed an emergency landing at City Field that further damaged the plane's landing gear but resulted in no injuries, according to emergency personnel. Despite the risk of paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, Southeast Alaska has a robust dive fishery that includes gooey duck clams. The harvest depends on weekly testing results from the Department of Environmental Conservation Laboratory in Anchorage. This scenario could change in the not-too-distant future. In part 2 of a 2-part series, KCAW's Emily Kwong tracks plans to launch a commercial testing lab in Sitka.
These are the geese that lay the golden eggs.
If you've ever seen Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, you may remember that scene with the golden eggs.
Are they chocolate eggs?
Golden chocolate eggs.
The green-haired Oompa Loompas weigh the eggs on a scale to decide if they're good or bad.
If it's a good egg, it's shined up and shipped out all over the world. But if it's a bad egg, down the chute.
The same could be said for gooey ducks. These giant bivalves with lolling necks like space worms have a high market value, where they're called jiangba bang, or elephant trunk clams, in China. Because these clams run the risk of carrying PSP toxins, divers cannot harvest an area before a few of its clams have been sent to the DEC lab and cleared for consumption.
If you're lucky, you get that sample on a plane that day and it gets up to the lab in Anchorage.
Larry Traney is a diver and member of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association, or SARDFA. Harvest has to happen within a week, which means that by the time divers get a test result, they tend to do all their actual harvest in just one day. And that's not a lot of time. It's dangerous work, which Traney believes could benefit from the kind of lab Sitka Tribe wants to open.
I can see that that would save time on the sampling and give us more days in which to conduct our diving. I think it's an excellent idea.
That's the appeal of a lab in Southeast. One Sitka Tribe hopes will persuade divers like Traney, shellfish growers, and harvesters to relocate some of their testing work to Sitka.
It was two offices, so he removed a wall and made this one large space.
The man with the plan is shellfish biologist Chris Whitehead, who pitched the idea for a biotoxin lab to Sitka Tribe 2 years ago.
I got really busy at writing grants, and somehow they all got funded, and now it's a matter of doing the work.
When we get our first order, it's going to be like the Christmas, like, oh my gosh! Yeah.
Jessica Gill is the tribe's fish biologist. The most eagerly anticipated order is for the Receptor Binding Assay, or RBA machine. The machine isn't authorized to test gooey ducks for PSP yet, just mussels and softshell clams. But Chris Whitehead believes that will change soon. And the exciting thing about the machine is that it eliminates the traditional testing method practiced by labs throughout the country.
They run what's called a mouse bioassay. So they inject this slurry of shellfish into a mouse.
And time how long it takes for the mouse to die. Based on that number, the lab can calculate the relative toxicity of the gooey duck for humans. With the RBA method, no mice need be harmed, and Gill, for her part, is relieved.
So I don't think I could take the lab manager job saying, oh, I'm going to kill a bunch of rats today.
With staff to be trained and tests to launch, the goal is for the lab to become a source of unrestricted funds for the tribe. But among SARDFA and other potential customers I spoke with, the big question on their minds was this. Would the state of Alaska be okay with handing PSP testing over to a commercial entity?
Well, I think that if they achieve FDA certification, that would be a terrific benefit to the Southeast Alaskan communities.
Elaine Bussey Floyd, the Environmental Health Director of the DEC, said it would be nice to have a lab servicing Southeast, but it's never been done before, and for good reason. The state does PSP testing for free.
So it's possible that the big influx of customers that you might think you were going to get because of being closer, you might not get because you'd be charging and we wouldn't be.
Funding for PSP testing is safe this fiscal year, but that may change with future budget cuts. The lab in Sitka would also have to earn certification from an alphabet soup of agencies, such as the FDA and the International Shellfish Sanitation Commission. Easier said than done. But STA's Chris Whitehead has determination in spades.
For a long time, there's probably been a need to do something like this, and I don't know if I lucked out and just came in the right time to start it or what, but it, doors are opening for us to do this.
Whitehead hopes to win FDA certification by 2017 and to first test shellfish collected through subsistence by the Southeast Alaska Tribal Toxins Group, or SEAT. It's an ambitious plan, trying to address a basic problem.
It all started out, I just wanted to go dig clams and I had no one to call to see if it was safe or not.
And Whitehead hopes this little lab that could can answer that call. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Governor Bill Walker was recently adopted into the Tlingit Kagwantan clan. The ceremony happened during the 80th Assembly of the Central Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, where Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott was also given a Lifetime Achievement Award. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
We're going to adopt you into our clan.
In a video of Governor Bill Walker's adoption ceremony into the Kagwantan clan, a Tlingit tribal member places a $5 bill on the governor's forehead to symbolize a payment for the name.
Everybody repeat after me.
Then the crowd chants the governor's Kogwonton name four times. Now, he's a member of the Eagle's Nest House within the Kogwonton clan, which means Wolf Clan. The clan is part of the Eagle moiety. Walker said being adopted by the clan came as a complete surprise.
It was exciting, something I'd not been a part of before, and it was all brand spanking new to me, and it's just such an honor. My adopted name now is Goochwalk.
You know, it isn't a name from years ago. It was a name I came up with.
Leona Santiago is a tribal delegate from the Kogwonton clan. She says she came up with the name in 2008 for an adopted family member, and now it's the name given to the governor, Goochwalk.
Which means wolf eyes.
She says tribal elders wanted to adopt Governor Walker into the Kogwonton because of the lieutenant governor's native roots.
Byron Malott is raven, and the Tlingit way, eagle raven is a balance.
This 10,000-year-old tradition creates equal representation for Tlingit families. Few Alaskan leaders have been adopted into native clans.
It just makes the relationship so much more whole and rich.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott. He says Governor Walker is now like a brother-in-law.
It's special for me. It is special for Tlingit people. I know it is special for Alaska. The more we can bring those lives across this incredible state together, the stronger we are as a state. And so that was a good step.
Recently, Governor Walker introduced emergency regulations for the Indian Child Welfare Act. It would create lower barriers for extended family or tribal members to adopt native kids, essentially less bureaucracy. Leona Santiago said the timing had nothing to do with adopting Governor Walker into the Kogwonton clan.
No, that isn't what we did. We did it to set the balance because Byron Malott is a raven.
In the video of the ceremony, Governor Walker dances to a traditional Kogwonton song. He says, being governor, you have a lot of one-and-done moments.
And that wasn't. That was a life-changing moment for me, and I knew that.
Goochwalk, or Governor Bill Walker, said he will continue advocating on behalf of all Alaskans. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Francesca Fenzi in Nome, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.